Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up this hour, we talk about climate change. As you know, delegates from many, many countries, 192 countries all over the world, are meeting in Copenhagen for the next 2 weeks. The UN's top climate official said that time is up. Over the next 2 weeks, governments have to deliver. In an interesting development, I think, today, 56 papers in 45 countries have published a joint editorial on climate change, calling it a profound emergency and saying, unless we combine to take decisive action, climate change will ravage our planet and with it our prosperity and security. The dangers have been becoming apparent for a generation, and now the facts have started to speak. 11 of the past 14 years have been the warmest on record. The Arctic ice cap is melting, and last year's inflamed oil and food prices provide a foretaste of future havoc. In scientific journals, the question is no longer whether humans are to blame, but how little time we have got left to limit the damage. Yet so far, the world's response has been feeble and half-hearted. We'll have two guests with us during the course of this hour and many phone calls, I'm sure. Professor Dana R. Fisher is our guest for the first half hour, associate professor in the Department of Sociology at Columbia University. And the major aim of her research is to understand the ways that social actors engage in decision-making processes and the successes and failures of such efforts. She is the director of the Environmental Stewardship Project at the Institute for Social and Economic Research and Policy at Columbia University. Her first book, National Governance and the Global Climate Change Regime, she has Wisconsin ties, receiving her PhD and Master's of Science degrees from the Department of Sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Our phone number as we talk about this very important issue is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation. Professor Dana R. Fisher, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Kathleen.
What do you think about the UN's top climate official comment, time is up, over the next 2 weeks, governments have to deliver?
I think it's a wonderful, strong statement trying to motivate these leaders to take action finally and do something for the collective good of the world.
And do they have just this two-week period of time? I keep reading reports that maybe nothing's going to happen over 2 weeks, but wait until June, or it's good we're doing this because a year from now we're really going to do something.
Well, a lot of people, including many members of our administration, are saying that this is just the lead-up now to the next meeting. I think that there has been this attempt to lower expectations because it's really going to be a huge effort to get to some agreement this year, because so far there hasn't been a lot of consensus about how to take the steps that are needed.
And how do we get that kind of consensus? How do 192 nations during the next 2 weeks achieve consensus?
Well, the way consensus is supposed to happen in this UN framework is all of these leaders have sent representatives to meetings all over the world for the past 6 months to try to come to consensus so that all of the pieces were in place for the agreement in Copenhagen. So far, there hasn't been a consensus formed, and that's why everybody's now stepping back and saying, look, we need to be realistic and recognize that we're going to take steps here. But usually what would happen, or historically what would happen, is already there would be some level of agreement and everybody would know what at least the targets were with regards to emission reductions. And those are, so far, there's no agreement across countries on this.
And we're having problems with agreement because the developing nations are poor and they need to emit more harmful gases, and the United States doesn't want, because we're emitting tons of them for the quality of life, we don't want to emit fewer because the Chinese particularly and India are emitting a whole lot. So if they can do it, we ought to be able to do it. Or
well,
is that,
I would say that
the basis of
a lot? I think you're touching on a lot of the main issues here. I mean, I think first and foremost, the developed countries, which are the countries that were bound by the Kyoto Protocol, and I should just say the United States is not a party to the ratification of the Kyoto Protocol, so we're not bound by it. But the original idea was that developed countries would go first. And the United States and now recently Australia have made it very clear that they don't want to go first. And I don't think that the I know there's a lot of discussion in Washington and a lot of rhetoric coming out about how we shouldn't have to cut our emissions if China and India don't. But more importantly, if you look at the progress on the bill that's stalled completely in the Senate now that's supposed to regulate climate change or regulate CO2 emissions, there's a lot of resistance among businesses in the United States to reduce CO2 emissions. And so we're experiencing a lot of problems getting any policy through. And Australia has now said that they also are not very excited about regulating CO2 emissions. So if you can't have the developed countries at least saying they're willing to take steps, it's impossible to tell developing countries who are still in the process of industrializing and developing themselves to take steps as well.
Considering what many, many scientists have been saying for quite a few years, considering the rate at which the Arctic ice is melting, that we've had the warmest years on record for 10 of the last 12 years, I believe, is the figure. What is the problem with not recognizing how urgent this is? Because many scientists are saying this is very urgent.
I think that the issue here is not about recognizing how urgent it is, but rather about taking the political steps. Because I think that there's a lot of debate going on, and the debate is really about how people see dealing with the economy and reconciling economic growth with environmental protection. And I think the problem here is that the economy tends to think, and people who focus on the economy tend to think in a much more short-term timeline than people who are dealing with issues and focusing on issues like climate change.
Right, except that we've begun to see very, very dramatic pictures, haven't we? We've begun to see species not being able to feed themselves because their ice is gone. We're beginning to see rises in temperature and communities throughout the world being damaged by this already. It's frightening in a way that it may be, people say, too late at a certain point if you don't say, all right, this is urgent now. If we don't do something now, we're in big trouble.
You're completely right. The biggest problem is that the places that are having the largest effects of climate change or feeling the largest effects of climate change so far are not developed and they're not centers of human population. If instead of the ice caps melting, we were having huge disease vectors spreading throughout the United States, I could say with almost 100% certainty that action would have already been taken on the issue. But that's not the way that climate change works. And so the problem is, as much as we see these poor pictures of the polar bears and the penguins, it's very hard to go from polar bears and penguins to no more coal consumption in the United States.
Right.
I think that's the take-home, the hardest pill about this whole issue to swallow.
Yes. The issue still under consideration in Times report yesterday is a fast start fund of roughly $10 billion to be financed by wealthy nations to help poorer nations adapt to a changing climate and convert to less polluting forms of energy. The president has said providing this assistance is not only a humanitarian imperative, it's an investment in our common security, as no climate change accord can succeed if it doesn't help all countries reduce their emission. Will that be brought up in the next couple weeks, and is that a good thing to have on the table, this idea?
Well, they definitely have been trying to get buy-in from all the developed countries to contribute money, and when the president made this statement, he was finally committing to something that people have been waiting on for quite some time from the American delegation and from the U.S. administration. So the goal here is for everybody to pony up from the developed world to help the developing world. And Obama's statement is a very good step in the right direction.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you. We're talking about the climate change conference in Copenhagen the next 2 weeks. Professor Dana R. Fisher, associate professor in the Department of Sociology at Columbia University, is our guest the first half hour. Later, an assistant professor of public affairs and environmental studies at the La Follette School of Public Affairs, UW-Madison, will be joining us. Here's the number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we start our calls with Frank from Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hello.
Hi.
again, a very nice excellent guest on a very important topic. I would like to point out that the economists have very, very poor numbers for the future. The economists do. And so they discount the future almost to zero and look at the immediate costs. Your guest has said that. But we are past time. We haven't just run out of time. And about it, almost this time a year ago, there was a paper by a gentleman called Alan Myers from Oxford, which points out that we've used about half our exploitable petroleum as an energy source, and that if we were to use the next half, we would be looking at a future, millennia-long future, not of a world with an additional 2 degrees, but something like 6 and possibly more, you know, greater than 6 degrees centigrade. And scientists are very conservative. They're not alarmists. But unusually for a scientist, he wrote several popular articles, which appeared in The Guardian and so on, not reported in the United States, where he spoke as Colette's dad for his daughter and advised that we get off the carbon economy as quickly as possible. We have no more time, and we have no right to use the remaining petroleum reserves. There's going to be a necessary period where we transition, and they're essential, but that has to be quick. We don't have time, and we should not use that second half. And so thank you very much.
Before you go, Frank, I know you know a lot about this issue and follow it closely. What direction do we need to go in terms of energy? Alternative energy, what looks promising to you?
Well, the first thing is we can get a third of the way there without great expenditure, which is just efficiency. We can get a third of the way there. Then we're going to have to shift to renewables and things like solar. And solar looks viable, and you know, we wouldn't even use the land mass of a fifth of Saudi Arabia to turn the planet into a solar-driven planet. I would point out that the trees have already been doing this for substantially more than millennia. So thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Professor Fisher.
I just would say that I think Frank's points are very well taken, and I would just stress even more the difference in time frames here, because if we look at economists, they certainly are focusing more on the immediate level. But what's challenging also is the fact that if we look at policymaking, the timeline is very different. For example, what's happening in the Congress right now is about the debate over whether or not a national policy on climate change should even exist. And there's no question that the debate is going to go on into 2010. And it's very possible that nothing will be passed for a couple of years past that. And so the congressional timeline is very different from the timeline with regard to climate change, as well as different from the timeline with regard to economic projections, which is one of the reasons that there's been so much difficulty in making policy on the issue.
What about his point, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are concerning what needs to be done. Can we at least reach a consensus if we lived in the developed world that we need to change our lives? Would we agree, do you think, most of the people participating from the developed world at the Copenhagen conference, that we can do a lot of this if we are more efficient? The newspaper article today said that we need to change our lifestyles. The era of flights that cost less than the taxi ride to the airport is drawing to a close. We will have to shop, eat, and travel more intelligently. We will have to pay more for our energy and use less of it.
I think that the description in the newspaper sounds very fair. I think the problem is that, well, I think, you know, Frank is definitely right that a lot of this can be done through efficiency. The problem is the kind of efficiency that we're talking about is not... not all of it is pain-free. Not all of it is just turning off the light when you're not in the room. It also involves turning down the heater and turning down the air conditioner in the summer. And it also involves the choices with regard to the kinds of vehicles we choose to drive and how many miles we put on those vehicles each year. So some of it will hurt somewhat. Even the easy stuff will hurt. And then the other stuff will probably hurt even more.
Right. More phone calls in just one moment. We're talking about the conference on climate change taking place as we speak. Well, they should be unless they're breaking for dinner in Copenhagen. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Dana Fisher, Dana R. Fisher is our guest, associate professor in the Department of Sociology at Columbia University, director of the Environmental Stewardship Project at the Institute for Social and Economic Research and Policy at Columbia. And we're taking phone calls for her. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have a couple lines open. If you'd like to join our conversation on climate change, the number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we go next to Alan from Superior. Hi, Alan.
Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, my comments would be, first, that while I agree that there's a lot of really important things that can be done from an energy efficiency point of view, I am disappointed by the general conversation that happens on this topic pretty much now internationally. I guess I would fall under the category of someone who's a denier. I don't believe that it is concluded that global warming is human-caused. I think there's pretty good evidence that global warming is happening, but not necessarily that it's human-caused, as you look back through the millennia, if you will, on climate change. And so the kind of alarmist rhetoric, I think, doesn't actually help. A more interesting conversation that obviously no one's having anymore is what's the real cause. But the second conversation is, what would we choose to do about it? If we want to now artificially try and cool the or reduce the warming, you know, that could be an interesting debate that we would have as a world population. And there probably are things we can do about it. Almost independent of that, this does become an economic conversation where there are things that should be done to reduce the use of fossil fuels. But once we take it to kind of an extremist environmental view, we end up eliminating a lot of the choices, which would also obviously reduce carbon consumption. We should be using nuclear power. We should be looking at methane and other gases. So it just frustrates me that we boil this down to kind of a simplistic view of the environment. We quickly skip past a lot of the facts, which might change the discussion. And while I don't mean this to sound overly negative, we have a program where we talk about the departments of sociology and public affairs instead of either climatology or economics. I think economics is pretty important here.
And what if you're wrong? What, as so many of the world scientists who have studied this for a long period of time say, indeed, there is no question that it is due to human activity, and we better pay attention or we're going to have massive disease. We are going to have significant problems on this planet. What if that's the truth?
Well, first of all, I suspect that that's not true, but
you suspect
question,
it.
What if you're wrong? And part of the way you'd answer that question is you'd look back through history and you'd say, are there periods of time in the past before there's been massive emissions of CO2 by humans of both higher temperatures and higher CO2 content, and what happened? And I think you'd come to the conclusion that while our lives would certainly change if there's climate warming, it wouldn't necessarily be a disaster.
Professor Fisher.
Well, I would just say, Alan, that you know, your comments have been echoed by many climate skeptics around the United States. You know, it's true. I'm a sociologist. I believe in the scientific process, and I follow the findings of my colleagues in the natural and climate sciences, and I focus on the peer-reviewed work. And although you may not believe it and you may not accept it, peer-reviewed literature on climate science has come to a very, very strong level consensus. And if you want to talk about the extremist environmental view, and that's a quote that you were using before, the extremist environmental view is a question of how low the CO2 concentration should be in the atmosphere right now. Jim Hansen, a colleague of mine here at Columbia, who tends to be very, very conservative with what he thinks is an estimation for an acceptable level, says 350 parts per million. But if you want to talk extremist, we should get to lower. But that would be the level of extremism. I mean, you know, my research is focusing on the human dimensions of the issue in terms of understanding the politics, and that's what's going on right now in Copenhagen, because most of the world agrees right now that
the scientists have spoken, and they've come to a level of consensus that can't be ignored anymore.
Would you say, thank you for the call, Steve, Alan, that Alan's view is shared by a significant number of Americans, some reports are saying, so that when the Senate tries to deal with climate change next year, it's going to have a hard time getting anything rolling?
Well, this environmental skepticism or climate skepticism is definitely widespread in this country, but I would argue, and some of my research has found, that it's actually the product of climate skepticism being funded by right-wing think tanks and conservative groups, as well as groups that are funded by the fossil fuel industry. So it's not just that individuals around this country are waking up one day and saying, I don't buy the climate science. What's happening is they're being fed information that has been manufactured by quote-unquote scientists who are funded by the fossil fuel industry because they don't want to have their economy, you know, they don't want their incomes to go down.
Right.
It's a cyclical process. Now, those same industries are also paying millions of dollars for lobbyists who are going to lobby against regulating coal and regulating oil production and extraction and consumption. So what we end up with is a cycle that has to be broken.
Steve from Mount Horeb, hi.
Hi, yes, thank you. Thank you for this program. Very timely. Yes, I agree with your guest on efforts toward energy efficiency. And my question is what her recommendations are for, I guess, our the easiest fruit to pick. And then I'd like to know what the energy efficiency is or the miles per gallon is of our electric grid currently.
Should I answer?
Yes, go right ahead,
okay,
Professor
sorry.
Fisher. Sorry.
Let's see. I would start with, my recommendations for energy efficiency, I would just say, and I should just start out with the caveat that I'm a sociologist. My specialty is in energy efficiency. But, you know, I did spend 5 long winters in Madison, Wisconsin, so I know something about what the challenges are in the Midwest. And I would say probably the lowest hanging fruit is things like insulation. Things like making sure that your house is, you know, insulated, that your windows aren't drafty, that your doors aren't drafty, seeing what you can do to reduce the number of times you have to get back in your car to go somewhere. If you're going to go out to do errands, you go over the west side only one time during the day rather than going and then coming back and going and then coming back to the degree that you can. And, of course, whenever possible, there are wonderful biking trails. So get on your bicycle, and then you can get some exercise at the same time. Now, obviously, that's not possible during certain times of the year unless you're more hardcore than I am. But, you know, that's the lowest hanging fruit. It's the things that we can do individually in our houses and to take care of, you know, make sure our families are taken care of, but we're also trying to reduce the amount of consumption with regard to energy. With regard to the more specific question about vehicle miles, and our grid, I actually don't know the answer to that because that's not my specialty, I'm sorry to say.
Thanks very much for the call. We go next to Mark from Appleton. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, how are you?
I'm good.
Good.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Gus is a sociologist, is that correct?
Yes.
Am I right?
Yes.
Yeah. And she was talking about, like, pandemics of disease. I wonder... how come she knows if she's social? She's not like, she doesn't have, I don't think she has any ideas about any problems.
She's the author of National Governance and the Global Climate Change Regime and is very familiar with the whole body of literature. Do you have a question, Mark?
Yes, people who are talking about this climate change are picking like very nice animals like penguins that people like, or polar bears, but actually, polar bears population growing.
No, it's not. That's not true.
It's growing. It's proven. It was talked when Al Gore had his interview somewhere. They proved that the population of polar bears are growing.
Well, we had the foremost polar bear expert on the air last week, and he said that simply is not true.
Down the polar bears, yeah, and you know, yeah. Like 1,000 years ago, the Greenland was without ice, and the people grow. Rye on the Greenland.
Professor?
I don't know the history of Greenland, although my understanding, I mean, it would be worth asking an expert about this, of course. I'm not really sure there's a question in there. I do a lot of work with people who are health experts and who do work on climate change, because we do a lot of interdisciplinary, cross-disciplinary research dealing with the human dimensions of climate change, of which obviously disease is one. So that would be my expertise there. And I've read quite a bit of the literature.
As for polar bears, the number of polar bears is not increasing in the world. I don't know where that information comes from. Do you, Professor?
I would just say that this probably all is linkable back again to the climate skepticism and the manufactured research that's being distributed in this country to create a popular sense of denial regarding climate science.
Right.
I mean, this is a perfect example, because I haven't heard of any data that suggests that polar bear populations are growing.
No, of course not. And so you, in the interest of what is the truth, you need to know what the truth is and not just say figures like that because you got them somewhere and that's just your truth. That's something that can be verified, it seems to me.
Yeah, I mean, what I would say is just that people need to think about the sources and always question the sources of the information when you get information.
Okay, we'll take one more phone call. No, we have to switch guests. Thank you so much, Professor Fisher, for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Kathleen. Take care.
Yeah, we're talking about climate change this hour of the program. Our guest the first half hour, Professor Dana Fisher, an associate professor in the Department of Sociology at Columbia University and director of the Environmental Stewardship Project at the Institute for Social and Economic Research and Policy at Columbia University. We change guests now. Professor Gregory Nemeth is joining us, Assistant Professor of Public Affairs and Environmental Studies at the La Follette School of Public Affairs, University of Wisconsin-Madison. We're looking at all that's being brought to the table in Copenhagen as delegates from, 1,500 delegates and at least 100 world leaders and people who have certain points of view are descending or have descended on Copenhagen for the climate conference. And we're looking at how they are addressing this. We're looking at the disparity between those nations that have and those nations that do not have in terms of their carbon footprint and what the world can agree on and how you form consensus and how you look at the urgency of this issue. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. For you to join our conversation. Professor George Nemeth, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Good to be here. It's Greg, by the way.
Oh, it's Greg?
Yep.
Oh, you'd like to be called Greg. All right, Greg. tell me, what do you hope for? This is a huge conference that's taking place with people from all kinds of different countries, rich countries and poor countries and oil-producing countries and people who have been trying to be conscious when it comes to consuming energy. What do you hope will happen? That we'll get a major treaty out of this, or we'll at least get the discussion rolling and we'll get a major treaty next year?
Right. Yeah, I guess you could say there's probably a range of three possible outcomes. One is that nothing happens at all. Everyone goes home in disgust, and there's just a logjam. And I think that's probably unlikely to happen. There would be too much effort to make something happen here for that to happen. And domestically, there are a lot of countries that wouldn't find that acceptable. So I don't think we'll have that happen. On sort of the most optimistic end of the range, it could be that we come up with a global agreement that includes commitments by all the large, rich countries and at least some commitments by the developing countries, especially the large ones, to reduce their emissions of greenhouse gases over the next 5 or 10 and 20 years. And I think that's unlikely to happen either, just because it's not realistic. And if we did come up with commitments that way, they probably wouldn't be considered credible because each of the countries would have to go back and implement them with domestic legislation. There's just not enough support for that right now, although there could be in the future. And that sort of brings up sort of the intermediate outcome, which I think is most likely and is probably the one to hope for the most, would be to set up some kind of framework, sort of get the institutional mechanisms in place so that we could come up with that most optimistic framework, say, in another year or two. There's been a lot of progress over the last couple of years to actually do something seriously about this issue. There have been a lot of meetings that haven't occurred at this, as you said, sort of the highest level there is of all the countries of world leaders attending. But having sort of lower-level people meeting, sometimes one-on-one meetings, such as China and the U.S. had last month, and then smaller groups, such as the G8 or 17 large countries. So there's a lot of progress happening on a lot of fronts. So that's sort of encouraging to think that something will happen. But at the end of 2 weeks, or say at the end of next week, when President Obama visits the conference, I think at that point, hopefully we'll have something in place to have some real commitments. And probably one of the most a couple important things I would hope for. One is that we kind of reshuffle the way we categorize countries. So far, and this is the legacy of the last 15 years of climate policy, we have two types of countries. We have sort of the rich countries that are bigger emitters, and the poorer countries that historically have not been the big emitters. The big change is now there are several of the poorer countries that are big emitters and that aren't quite as poor as they used to be. And so it's not feasible to continue that in the future to say that the rich countries have to do emissions cuts and the poor countries don't have to. So somehow recategorizing countries and potentially having some kind of carrot and stick so that the rich countries maybe give something to the poor countries, such as funding for adaptation or clean energy technology, and that the developing countries, especially the large, rapidly growing ones, give back with some real commitments on their own to do things like investing in energy efficiency or deploying cleaner energy technologies and potentially having frameworks for real emissions reductions in the next 5 or 10 years, because mm-hmm. we can't get there without them doing that as well.
Yeah. Tell me, I know that there are 192 different stories here, but let me center on one for a moment, because it seems to be a place that you normally wouldn't think would be right on this issue and fairly forward-looking. South Africa, I have read, became on Sunday, yesterday, the latest country to announce an emissions target. Over the next 10 years, it would reduce emissions by 34% from business as usual. By 2025, 42%. Effectively leveling off and thereafter beginning to decline. The environmental group Greenpeace said this makes South Africa one of the stars of the negotiations. Tell me why a place like South Africa would be a star, and then you've got at the other extreme Saudi Arabia, who's fighting any kind of cap tooth and nail. So it's what a conglomeration of places.
Right.
But
yeah.
Will places like South Africa receive attention here for doing this, and why have they done it?
I think they will. So I said one thing that seems to be happening is important is that the rich versus poor divide is realigning, and there's been sort of this category of countries that are called the BRICS, which is Brazil, Russia, India, and China, and that's kind of been a category that was created by sort of rich countries, especially investors in rich countries. There's a new category that's kind of emerged called the basic countries, which is Brazil, South Africa, India, and China. So Russia's not included, and South Africa is. And so now you've got a block of countries that are really sort of key to where this goes next, because they're not as poor and don't need quite as much help as these other countries, but they're growing quickly, and their emissions are increasing. And so one question is, why would they do anything sort of preemptively on their own? Why not just kind of wait it out for the rich countries to solve the problem? I guess I'll just put a few reasons out there, and I won't say exactly what's motivating South Africa, so that's a pretty recent announcement. But one thing you could say is that there really are co-benefits that you get from reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So local air pollution, there's no question that that goes down, and there's no question that has human health impacts and benefits as air quality improves. So that's certainly something that China's thinking about, certainly something that India and South Africa are thinking about as well. So that's one reason that you get sort of a local near-term benefit. Another is that you may find that doing things like energy efficiency, which is also helpful for greenhouse gas emissions, reduces your dependence on foreign sources of energy. And so you can reduce your imports and use those resources for potentially more productive uses. Another possibility is that, you know, this climate change and energy is not the only issue that these countries that are interacting with each other deal with together. And so maybe there are potentially positive outcomes you might get on trade or other concerns internationally that some goodwill on climate change might get you. And then the other one I'll just put out there is we can't ignore that the damages that we're worried about here, so the damages of actually climate change happening, are real costs, and they're really going to happen to lots of countries. And it's no coincidence that several of these countries we were just talking about, India, China, and South Africa, are countries that are physically just for mainly geographic, but also sort of the composition of their economy as well, are dependent and vulnerable to the types of changes we're talking about. So they probably have a special interest in actually making something happen. And so it might be enough there to actually catalyze them to do something in terms of reducing emissions. So there's several reasons why a country would actually do something preemptively on reducing emissions rather than just kind of waiting it out and being a free rider for the rest of the world to solve the problem.
Ed from Madison, hi.
Hi, good morning. I think the real opportunity that we would have to change the conversation here in America, and particularly up here in Wisconsin, is looking at the country that this conference is going on in and see how it has changed its economy and its basis in energy, and how that is pretty comparable to our situation here, climate-wise and culturally. And I think there's a lot to be learned there. I think one thing that we're not getting done well in this country is articulating what's really going on already in terms of climate change and what its costs are. I think one of the business sectors that skeptics ought to look at is the insurance sector, who have a live interest in looking further out than this quarter, this year, or a five-year plan. And they've already adjusted based on a clear recognition that climate change and other environmental changes are coming.
Interesting. What do you think we need to learn from Denmark, Ed?
Well, they are almost the highest in terms of transforming towards renewable sources and local sources. And if you look at their measures of well-being, economic, social, and health, they're right at the top, or in the top 10, I think in the top 5. They're doing terrific, and there's a lot of commonality with our social capital, our physical capital here, and Wisconsin could be an equivalent of Denmark if it chose to. And I think we're going to have to take this on at a more local, state and local level because there's too much inertia in our federal system. And it's much too much bought and influenced by the present regimes that don't want to change their forms of business and their ways of making money.
Professor Nimitz.
Yeah, I agree with Ed. Denmark's a great example to look at. It's not the only example, but it's a great one to look at because they've sort of, I think, thrown away this notion that there's this fundamental trade-off between economic growth and environmental protection. They, as Ed DeColler mentioned, they're very high on environmental protection, but also have 10% of their imports as of a couple years ago were from wind turbines. So they're actually using their efforts to invest in green technology to protect their own environment, but also to create jobs and create and grow their economy as well. And if you go to Denmark, you'll see that it's not a place that seems to be suffering by having protected its environment too much. Conversely, it appears to be thriving as a result of trying to get on the next wave of potentially where investment's going internationally in the next and innovation in the next couple of decades. But also, it's not something they've done overnight. They've been working on these technologies for the last 20 to 30 years or so. And so it's been a persistent effort to create these technologies, to create, develop an export industry, to develop jobs, coupled with strong concern about the environment and environmental protection. But it's not the only place that's doing it, and China is probably another place that's way ahead of the game in terms of making the types of investments that Denmark has been doing.
More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about the Conference on Climate Change in Copenhagen the next 2 weeks. And our guest this half hour, Professor Greg Nimitz, Assistant Professor of Political Affairs and Environmental Studies at the La Follette School of Public Affairs, University of Wisconsin in Madison. Two lines are open, so feel free to join us. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to your phone calls. Ray from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I'm a bike rider, and I definitely agree that we should stop using oil and coal and all that. But the argument that's made about we are causing this global warming through using those fossil fuels always leaves out the solar aspect. The solar cycle during the last years has been extremely active, and a lot of energy the Earth receives from the sun actually comes from the sunspots. Now, this last year, we've had 1 year with almost no sunspots, and us people here in Wisconsin know that we had a very cool summer this year. And when you look back in history, I think it's called the Mauder Minimum. It was a time back in the 1600s into the early 1700s, where scientists then were able to tell there were very few sunspots, and we had a mini ice age at that time. Now, if you want to bring the solar cycle question into the argument, then you will make a stronger argument. But as long as you leave out the biggest earth warmer there is and its effects on the earth and pretend that there is no effect from the sun to this argument, you'd have probably fewer skeptics. And the solar cycle is always ignored, and I never get an answer to these questions.
Are you a scientist, Ray?
No, but I can answer that one.
Absolutely. There are two. The climate change that we've seen is not completely due to man-made activities, and there are two other explanations. One is the solar cycle, and the other is volcanoes. So volcanoes put sulfates up into the upper atmosphere and reflect sunlight, so that actually creates some cooling. So you've got some intense and of solar activity through the solar cycle and volcanoes. But contrary to what the caller said, those have been included in climate models for a long time. They are well characterized. They're not actually that uncertain relative to other parts of the climate system. And so that is taken into account, and there's no one that is making a serious scientific case right now that the warming that we've seen over the last 150 years can be attributed to the solar cycle. And then volcanoes are something you have to control for, but that goes in the other direction. So those are included and absolutely are contributors to the system, but they're also well characterized in climate models, and there's not really any sort of remaining argument that can be made that those are can explain the changes that we've seen over the last 150 years. Mm.
Well, what's at play here? I mean, I don't want to spend the whole hour on whether or not climate change is happening, because we're having a conference with all the nations on Earth the next 2 weeks who are concerned about this issue, and you're not going to have a lot of deniers there, and it's the head of states, et cetera, and a lot of countries have done quite a bit, but you do need everybody in the world to do something about this.
Yeah.
I guess just one question, but and then we'll get off this and talk about what else needs to happen in Copenhagen, but why is it, do you think, is it the scientists who need better PR to explain what their work is? Is it just that we are so entrenched a certain way of life and so much money or so many people and countries are making money off
right.
oil, that's the problem? What is the problem here?
Well, let me just back up a couple things, just make clear that so there's no sort of claims that we're not seeing any climate change. So the temperatures are increasing.
Right.
Snow cover is decreasing. Sea level is rising. So no one's arguing with that. And the two questions people are, there's some question about are how much of it is due to humans, and we talked about that. A little bit. And then the other question is, how much change will there be? And I think the fundamental problem there is that we can't nail down the answer to that exactly in precise terms of how bad the problem will actually be. And that makes it difficult to come to consensus on what to do about the problem, because that means we need to treat the problem sort of like the way we treat risks like fires or theft or things like that, things we buy insurance for. And so far, the problem has not been framed as one where we don't know how bad this problem is going to be. We know there'll be a problem. It might be pretty bad or it might be really bad. But in either case, we have to do something about it, because the worst outcome is not tolerable. And so far, that sort of framing of the problem has not gotten a lot of traction. I'm not quite sure why. But I think if we start thinking about the problem in terms of saying it's a risk and we need to do things to do that are equivalent to buying insurance against this problem happening, I think that's a much, ultimately, in the longer term, it's a much more tractable way to get political support for this, rather than to say this problem is going to be catastrophic, and if we don't do something by the end of next week, then, you know, our cities will be lost and people will start dying. And there's some truth to that, but I don't think that's really the best accurate way to portray the science and also to elicit political support.
Yeah, but if there's some truth to that, it does create a sense of urgency, and you go, oh my gosh, we better do something.
Yep, absolutely. But sort of trying to pin it down on precise estimates of what's likely to happen in 10 or 20 or 50 years, you know, the science and the rest of the sort of work about this problem is not precise enough to say what exactly it will be. So I think it's better to characterize it as a problem of risk that requires some insurance rather than one that we know the outcome and we need to avoid it.
Thanks, Ray, for the call. Paul from Green Bay. Hi.
Good morning. How are you today?
All right, Paul. How are you?
I'm fine. I have a question. who stands to make money? If I'm a scientist, which I'm not, and I say that there's global warming and it's human caused, where am I going to make any money? Why would I say that falsely? That's my question. Thank you.
So you're trying to, if you're a climate scientist and you're trying to say, is there a motivation for you to say whether it's not human attribution? I'm just a little confused about that. Maybe I'll just try to guess at what...
He said that if there is, what's in it for them to say that it is humanly caused? They're not going to make money off that.
Right. I agree. I think the if there's any financial motivation for scientists, it's tiny relative to what they could be doing if they worked in other sectors. And so if a scientist wanted to get rich, they'd be much better off leaving science and going somewhere else rather than trying to increase their access to research grants by trumpeting the role of human activity in global warming. So I don't think there's really a strong motivation there.
It's really something to think of, all of the people who are going to be in Denmark the next 2 weeks and many who are already there, 100 leaders of the world, these huge delegations, and of course groups of people who are concerned about the issue. What a meeting.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't happen very often. But, you know, the other thing to think about and be conscious of is this has been in the works for 17 or 18 years. And so the last time the first time we had kind of this level of engagement was in 1992 in Brazil. And that's where we agreed, including the U.S., signed on to saying that we would work to prevent dangerous man-made interference with the climate system. And so the next 17 years are trying to find ways to actually get down to actually doing that. But it is impressive, and I think it's a positive sign to think of, to see the degree of engagement, the fact that world leaders are coming to deal with this problem. It also reflects the fact that you can't ignore that it's an incredibly difficult problem, just more from a political perspective, that we're talking about a global public goods problem that is, the costs are going to occur in the near term, most of the benefits will be in the longer term, that we've got the rich and the poor have to work together on this problem. And then there's large uncertainty, I kind of mentioned, in terms of how expensive it will be to deal with the problem and how bad the problem actually will be. So if you put all those things together, it's sort of, you know, it sort of justifies, okay, it has taken a couple decades to get where we are on it. And maybe that's, you know, not so much a sign of failure, but a sign of actual persistence. And hopefully the next couple of years will be kind of reaping the fruit of all the institutions and the political will and the communication and the knowledge that we've gained over the last couple of decades on the problem.
Scott, you have a terrible phone line here. Go ahead, from Green Bay.
Is that any better?
Yeah, a little bit. Go ahead.
Okay, just a couple of quick points. One is, we talk a lot about consensus, and I'm not one of these, I hate the term denier. I like being called a skeptic. I mean, calling somebody a denier is actually kind of an insult, and there is a little background to that saying, global warming denier, like a Holocaust denier. But we talk about consensus of scientists, and we forget where there is consensus, there is not science, because science is not about consensus. Science is about proven facts. And the interesting thing is that if somebody wants to have a conversation about climate change, global warming, whatever you want to call it, if somebody is skeptical about it, I mean, they're treated as a pariah right now. I mean, you can't bring it up. And my one question to you, Kathleen, is I know you once or twice had somebody, scientists on, that disagree with it. In their science, where do you find it flawed? Because I know you totally buy into it. So when you've had somebody that's disagreed, a scientist that's been on your program, what about their science is flawed? Since you disagree with it,
I think, you know, all you have to do is look at what's happening in the world and have scientists point to that. My thought about this is that there is very, very, very little disagreement among people who have studied this for their lives, that the human beings are not causing that. It's just sort of a given. And so why debate this over and over and over again when it might be too late once we all agree that's the case?
No, I asked, what do you find in their science that's flawed?
Whose science?
When you've had people on, you've had scientists on that have disagreed with the cause of global warming. And so what in their science, since you had guests on that disagree with it, what in their science do you find flawed?
Yeah, you'll have to tell me who I had on, because I don't think we've had many people on like that.
That's interesting. Well, and well, then there's, you have, that's for sure, but don't you think you should have? I mean, if you don't think you have, but I know you've had people on.
Well, you know, I think that we're kind of past, this is a hard thing to talk about. Just quickly, we only have about 20 seconds left, Professor Nimitz. Do you think there's a legitimate debate here, or we're just so wrapped up in whether or not this is happening? I think it's pretty clear it's happening.
Yeah, I think we just have to distinguish the debates that are sort of driven by kind of self-interest and maybe narrow interests that might have to do with the winners and losers that might accrue to whatever we do about climate change. Distinguish that from what we know from how the atmosphere works and how the carbon cycle works.
Yeah, and on that note, we have to say goodbye. Professor Nimitz, thank you very much for being with us. And thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks for your calls, everybody. I'm furloughed tomorrow. I'm going to have my cholesterol checked. Woo!